accounting is by definition about the past. It's not a theory. So we have to, what we've been talking about for years is trying to help accountants think more theoretical, because in order to posit something for the future, you have to have a theory.
Hey, what's happening, gang? You are listening to Future Proof, and I am your host, Bill Sheridan. And oh, well, we've got royalty on the show today. Our guests are none other than Ron Baker and Ed Kless. They've done just about everything. I mean, where to begin with these two? First of all, they're two of the smartest cats that I know about this profession, about economics, about society, politics, you name it. They are two of the deepest thinkers about anything you want to know, and they'll challenge you to think deeper about it too. They're a bit fanatical about that, in fact, which is one of the things that I love about them. So it was fun. It was just really fun to sit down and chat with them for a while. We'll get to that conversation here in a few minutes. First, here's what caught my eye this week. It's a report from PwC out of the UK, and it's about automation. And I know, oh my God, another report about automation. How many times do we have to hear about how robots are coming to steal our jobs? Well, just settle down for a second, okay? Because this report focuses on an aspect of automation that a lot of folks don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about, and that's this: technology. All of these job-stealing robots you keep hearing about, they're going to create as many, if not more, jobs than they'll steal. So here's what the PwC report says. Artificial intelligence is set to create 7.2 million jobs over the next 20 years. That's slightly more than the 7 million jobs predicted to be lost to automation over the same time. So did you catch that? AI is going to create more jobs than it will destroy over the next 20 years. You don't often hear that narrative, do you? Now, a caveat: some professions will benefit more than others from that level of job creation. Healthcare, for example, will benefit significantly. On the other hand, manufacturing will be on the losing end of that spectrum. And how about our profession, accounting and finance? PwC lumps it into a category called financial and insurance activities, and that will be on the losing end as well. According to PwC, we're going to see an 18% increase in job creation and a 25% decrease in job displacement. So we've got some work to do. The point is, technology is as much a job creator as it is a job destroyer. And we don't often stop and think about that. Nor do we often stop and think about the fact that if we take the time to learn a few new vital skills, we might be able to kind of seamlessly move into some of these new jobs that technology is going to be creating. So I think the point is that we don't have to fade into irrelevancy. We can learn our way into some future-proofed careers. It really is our choice. So just an interesting report and some food for thought there. So anyway, back to our guests this week, Ron Baker and Ed Kless. Let's get the formalities out of the way. Let's start with Ron. He's a CPA, started his career in 1984 with KPMG, went on to found the Verisage Institute, which is a leading think tank dedicated to educating professionals. He is the leading evangelist for value pricing and killing the timesheet. He, in fact, wrote the book on that subject. In fact, he's written a number of books on that subject. He's a fixture on Accounting Today's list of the 100 most influential people in accounting, and has been inducted into the CPA Practice Advisor Hall of Fame. Moving on to Ed, he's a senior director of partner development and strategy at Sage, a senior fellow at the Verisage Institute, and he is co-host with Ron of an absolutely brilliant podcast called Soul of the Enterprise, the Business in the Knowledge Economy. Great podcast. Give it a listen. He and Ron just recently celebrated their 200th episode of that podcast, which in the podcast community is a pretty big deal. So all of that is just lip service to the fact that these guys are guys you need to listen to. They know their stuff, and they're not afraid to tell you about what you need to know and about where this profession is going and what you need to do to stay ahead of the curve. So, I mean, I could talk forever, but let's get on with it. Here's Ron Baker and Ed Kless. So Ron, Ed, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us, Bill.
Tell me a little bit, how did you guys get started working together? What was the genesis for all of this?
Oh, go ahead, Ed.
Oh, well, there's two sides to every story, Bill. So I guess the story starts with an email I got from Taylor McDonald. when he was at Sage. He, I don't know if the backstory is this. I'm at Sage 15 years this week.
Yeah, congratulations.
15 years and 6 days. Wow. And at some point relatively early in my tenure at Sage, I get a all caps, you know, email, which is how Taylor tends to communicate with people, and you know, read this book. And then he sent me a copy of Ron's book, as we refer to it at Verisage, the Old Testament. That would be the professional's guide to value pricing. And what's interesting is that he sent me a copy, but I had read it a while ago and put it aside. We had implemented some of the things, some of the principles of it at the firm that I worked at, which was not an accounting firm, it was technology, and we had moved a considerable amount, I wouldn't say all of our business, to a practice where we were doing value-based pricing. Eliminated the timesheet, sort of, but not completely. I would say that we were not completely off the timesheet when I left that entity. Anyway, so Ron, I got this book and reread it, decided I wanted to have Ron on as a guest of a program that I was doing called the Sage Leadership Academy. And we had a webcast. Actually, it was just a phone call. I don't even know if we did slides back then, right? So this was just a phone call with Ron and this group that I was leading. And Ron talked for an hour and then basically said, are there any questions? And there was just stunned silence, like absolute death breaking, like horrible. Nope. So like, okay. So we hung up the phone and Ron calls me up immediately after that and says, I'm sorry, that went terribly. I said, I don't think it was bad. I think it was just, this is back 15 years ago. This was a new message, right? You know, They were just kind of didn't know how to respond to it is really what was going on. He said, no, I want to make it up to you. So he volunteered to do a live program for us at one of our upcoming retreats. And I think then he came and did it. I forget where it was, Ron. Was it
Atlanta? It was Atlanta.
It was Atlanta. Okay. So you came to Atlanta and you did a day long thing. I think getting to know some of the people went a lot better, but there was still a couple people that were, you know, just arguing and that. I don't know if you believe this, Bill, but Ron has mellowed. Right? He used to be a little bit more than there was. I remember this one guy, Phil. Do you remember Phil, Ron?
He's sort of, yes. Vaguely. You
and Phil, like there was just bang. I mean, to the point where a lot of people are like, okay. But that was the start of it. And then we just started talking on a more regular basis. And you know, we agreed on a lot of things, although he's more conservative. I'm libertarian on some stuff. I recommended a book to him called The Answer to How is Yes, which I said that book and his book changed my life. And he said, well, if I got to read. Oh, I guess that's where you can pick up the story, Ron. Why don't you pick that up?
Yeah, that was our first phone call, Bill, when Ed said, I read two books last year that changed my life, yours and this book by Peter Block, The Answer to How is Yes. And I thought to myself, wow, who's this clown comparing me to? So this was back in the days of Borders. So I ran down to Borders, I think that night, and got the book. And I remember talking to Ed about it going, that's the book I wish I could have wrote.
Yeah.
The answer to how to yes is just really, really profound. So
that's great. And I don't want to spend all of our time talking about value pricing here, but good. Fill me in a little bit from that first conversation, stunned silence, to today. Are you still getting that kind of reaction, or is this idea starting to gain more traction?
No, I can say with ontological certitude that the billable hour is on the defense. Mm-hmm. We have put the billable hour on the defense. I think I've put it on trial for its life, giving it the death penalty. And nobody's arguing for the billable hour anymore.
Yeah.
The argument has shifted. The value pricing has been accepted. Now, it's just a matter of time. How long is it going to take to diffuse? I don't know. I don't think it'll happen in my lifetime. But intellectually, that war is over. The war, as I think, has shifted to the timesheet, because firms are still arguing that you need the timesheet, especially for cost accounting purposes, which I've been spending the last 2 or 3 years really getting into. And now we need to go out and take out cost accounting, which we're starting to do at Verisage.
Yep, yep. Now, what's the argument against that?
Well, cost accounting is the simplest way to say it is cost accounting is a metric. It's an opinion. depending on the cost accounting method I use, I can get a different result. So if you want to figure out, say, cost per item, cost per hour, whatever it is, there are like 8 or 9 sanctioned cost accounting methods by GAAP. I can use lean, I can use full absorption, I can use marginal, I can use activity-based costing. Every one of those, every one of them will throw off a different number. So I won't get an exact price or cost per product or per service. I'll get a range, and that range can be pretty large. Well, Bill, it brings into mind Segal's law. A man with one watch is certain of the time. A man with two never is. So cost accounting is an opinion. And what we're arguing is firms need to model cash flow and capacity, because cash is a fact. Cash is an actual measurement. If I'm counting people coming into the door of my business, I don't get to decide how I count them. It's 1, 2, 3. With cost accounting, I can make all these decisions. So there's a difference between metrics and measurements. Cash is a measurement. And that's why we think firms need to model cash better and capacity planning.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I guess one of the things that I admire most about you guys is this type of stuff, right? Your ability to think about this profession at a level that people who are part of the profession can't or won't a lot of times. I mean, you know, their accounting and finance professionals are busy just churning through their work every day, and you guys are really thinking deeply about what they do. So I guess my first question is how should accounting and finance professionals be thinking about this profession? Does that question even make any sense? How do we start thinking differently about moving this profession, which by definition looks backward most of the time, accounting for things that have happened? How do we start thinking more about moving this profession forward?
Well, let me jump in. And, you know, Ron, I'm sure we'll have a different spin on this, although I probably got this from him, is they should think about it more theoretically. Right, and they want to think of it in terms of absolutes, right? Because the accounting is an equation, right? Debits equal credits, right? So it always comes out debits equal credits. That's in every system everywhere. So the framework for how they think is balance, right? Mm-hmm. And the truth is that we live in a world that's unbalanced,
yeah,
right? That debits don't really equal credits in the real world. The example that I use all the time on this is, why was it that WhatsApp was purchased by Facebook for $17 billion when it was 30 people, most of them in Georgia, the country, not the state, by the way, writing code? I mean, the book value on that company, if it was $17 million at the time, I would have been surprised. So what accounts for the difference between the $17 billion that Facebook paid for them and the $17 million that was their, quote, book value of the company, right? And I think, Ron, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was Paul O'Byrne that said that goodwill, which is where the difference got booked when that transaction happened, is how accountants measure their ignorance.
Right.
Right? And what accounting is by definition about the past. It's not a theory. So we have to. What we've been talking about for years is trying to help accountants think more theoretical. Because in order to posit something for the future, you have to have a theory, right? Because I think Creighton Christensen said, you know, data is only available about the past, right? So by definition, conclusive data is only available about the past. So in order to look into the future, we have to look at a different theory. And here's the thing: you can't, unless your theory is the future is like the past plus 5% or plus 10%, which is what most accountants do when they start talking about budgets.
Right.
Right. If that's your theory, it's not. It turns out it's not a very good one.
Right. Right.
Right. So you have to use something else. So, and there's no number on your financial statement that is predictive of future financial performance. The question is, what are? And then that's where we get into things like, is net promoter score predictive of the future? We don't know. I think the jury's still out on that. I think it's good. I think it's better than trying to use revenue as a predictor of, you know, what's going to be happening in the future. Mm-hmm. So my short answer is, they have to think more theoretically. And in order to do that, they have to get outside of the accounting profession. Ron, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a multifaceted answer, Bill, but I would say obviously we have to change from being historians with bad memories to being able to peer into the future, like Ed says, and that requires theory and all of that. And the move to, you know, shift the profession to consulting mode has been around. Geez, how long have we been talking about this? Mm-hmm. How much progress has really been made? The only progress that has been made on this, I think, is in the bigger firms, the big four. They actually have consulting arms, some of the top 100 firms. You know, I think that's a natural for CPAs to move into that space, but there's challenges there, right? Because experts are paid for answers, whereas consultants are paid for questions. Mm-hmm. And CPAs think if they ask questions, they look stupid, right? If I go to a CPA and ask them a tax or an audit question, they give me an answer. But if you're in a consulting mode, you're not paid for the answer. The client has the answer. You're paid for drawing out the question and, you know, asking the more beautiful questions. So that's one thing, and that's more micro level. The macro level, what frustrates me about our profession is the lack of innovation. We are a regulated monopoly, and regulated monopolies are not hotbeds of innovation. You know, if they were, we'd have Vacuum Tube Valley in West Virginia. we've got this government evergreen revenue. Every time the tax law changes, every time there's new GAAP rules, whatever, Dodd-Frank, Sarbanes-Oxley. Here's the profession that failed with audits, and then they get Sarbanes-Oxley passes and the profession grows by, you know, a couple billion dollars. That's insane. Mm-hmm. I think the profession should lose its monopoly. I don't think we should be certified by the states. And I think competition should be allowed to offer a test and audit work in other ways. There's other ways to attest the validity of financial statements other than an audit opinion. You could buy insurance. There's all sorts of things we could do. But to think that the profession having a monopoly on this is serving the public, I think is the height of arrogance. That's what troubles me most about the profession.
So that strikes me as an idea that would meet a whole lot of resistance when you're
incredible
talking
incredible resistance.
The profession. Yeah,
is there any hope that? Do you think that that would actually fly with a lot of folks in this profession,
it wouldn't fly with the folks in this profession any more than getting rid of the sugar subsidy would fly with the sugar farmers, right? They love it. It's a concentrated benefit, but it's a dispersed cost. So, but if we were really serious about audit reform, look how all the stupid rules we have about it revolving around independence. Mm-hmm. But the elephant in the room, and Sarbanes didn't address this, the profession refuses to address this, is how can an auditing firm be independent if it's paid by the company it's auditing?
Right.
Can we really be paid to be independent? I mean, economists look at this and just laugh, and they say what should happen at the least is the stock exchanges should hire the auditors. So if I'm listed on the New York or the S&P, let them pick the auditor and pay the auditor directly. And that would be at least real independence, or at least better independence than what we have. And why can't Lloyd's of London come in and offer financial statement insurance for those investors who are worried about it? Mm-hmm. If I'm worried about a company, you know, cooking the books, I can go to Lloyd's or other insurance companies and buy financial statement insurance. And then maybe the insurance companies would hire auditors. There'd still be a need for auditors. But the point is, who would they be paid by? It would no longer be by the company they're auditing.
Yep. And I'm sorry, Ed, go ahead.
No, well, to his credit, Barry Melanson, when he was on our show and also more recently at the Engage conference in Las Vegas, he did. You know, he's not going as far as Ron, clearly. But what he did say is that he does foresee in the very near future alternative ways of getting people into the profession that don't require the extraordinarily high degree of knowledge around every aspect of what an accountant knows, right? You know, and that we do need simply because of all of the technology, such as blockchain and AI, that are coming down the pike very quickly. We need people who have technical skills that have a baseline of accountancy, but don't. Not everybody needs to know how to, you know, fill out a tax return if they're not going to do tax returns.
Right.
Yep. So, you know, I see that as, I just wanted to give a little props where that's due, but Ron ultimately is still right. The real thing is the problem with the audit is that it's the wrong customer. It's not the customer isn't paying for it. Their true customer isn't paying for it.
That's a very interesting thought. So, and what you said one word that kind of struck me as interesting, innovation. What do you mean by innovation? How do you define it? I know what a lot of people think of as being innovative isn't what somebody else would think of. And so what do you mean by that word?
Well, Ed and I think, have a pretty expansive view of innovation. It's not just new technology. It's not just the new, iPad or iPhone or whatever, or the new product, new service like Google. It could be innovation around the business model. I mean, our business model hasn't changed in 100 years. We are using the same business model. The audit report hasn't changed in 100 years. One of the funniest things in the book, The End of Accounting, which I think you read, Bill, mm-hmm. by Baruch Lev, who we had on our show, he compares and contrasts, I think it's U.S. Steel, audited financial statements from 1910 or something with today's.
Right.
And they look the exact same. We haven't innovated the way we present information. The audit report still reads as bland as ever. I believe they should read like movie reviews. Mm-hmm. I think they should be more subjective. I think auditors should talk about where they disagreed with management, where they would have presented. And I also think they should be more willing to talk about the error rate in audits. You know, we present audits like they're accurate to the penny. That's absurd. Any data set is going to have a range of tolerable error. Auditors should have to disclose that, I think, and be more subjective with where they disagree with management. Reason I don't think they do that is because they're paid by these people. Mm-hmm. But if they weren't paid by these people, that wouldn't be an issue. And we could bring some innovation to the audit report function, our business model, the way we service clients, all of these things. We're running on a 100-year business model, and that's disturbing as well.
It's a little problematic given the way that the world is changing and how fast it's changing nowadays. Let's talk a little bit. Ed, you had mentioned theory, being more theoretical about how you think about this profession. So let's talk about that theory. What does the future of this profession look like to you guys? I mean, To hear you talk, Ron, makes me think that the sky is falling in some way. So what does the future look like to you guys?
Well, I don't want to present it like the sky is falling. All of this stuff about AI and all this decimating accountants and just ruining all these jobs. I think that's absurd at any level of the economy. I just think that AI and all of these tools are going to augment humans. But that aside, no, I don't think the profession's sky is falling because there'll always be government regulation and complexity. So there's always going to be a need for accountants and auditors. I do think blockchain has some repercussions that are pretty interesting for especially audit, right? If all the transactions run through a blockchain, why do you need auditors? And even the big four seem to recognize that. Now, the party line from Barry Melanson and others in the AICPA is, well, but we'll still need the auditors to examine the integrity of the blockchain. Well, I'm sorry, but CPAs don't have that capability. I'm not a computer scientist, so I can't examine a blockchain and see if it's got integrity, right? So either we're going to have to change our skills or the blockchain is going to largely replace the audit function or maybe just morph it into something else that's more real time, where investors can have access to it. But no, I think the future of the profession is actually kind of bright. You know, how can the future of the profession be doomed if the biggest worry out there, the biggest concern is the talent? Mm-hmm. Nobody can find talent. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you square those two things? You know, on the one hand, we're saying, oh, all these jobs are going to disappear. And on the other hand, every firm says, I can't find good people.
Right.
I don't know how to speak. Obviously, the demand is there. I think the future of the profession is pretty bright, but there's no doubt that we need to change.
Yeah.
Well, when we say the future of the profession, what do we mean by the profession, right? Is it the people who are in the governing bodies of the, such as the AICPA? Is that what we mean by the profession? Do we mean those practitioners? Because I think with any job, things are going to morph. You know, I don't think that suddenly, and this is from Daniel Susskind's book called The Future of the Profession, is, somebody is not going to show up one day and there's going to be a robot in their chair. right? That's not how it's going to work. Right. Slowly over time, what happens is different tasks that professionals do get offloaded to machines. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it, there's not much difference between what we think of as of AI today and the first, you know, disk-based computer programs that used to run accountants. I mean, in a sense, posting an accounts payable transaction in a dual floppy system was a bot,
right?
It was a bot. It processed that transaction through what somebody used to put on paper, right, and bring to different places. So it's a bot. So we just have much more sophisticated bots now.
Yeah. Right?
And those are going to continue to happen. And you know, I always forget who to attribute this quote to, but it's a great one. I use it almost everywhere. Is that, you know, if your job gets taken by a bot today, your job probably sucks anyway. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, because it's pretty boring, right? So the question then becomes is what I don't know about the future of the profession is defined by that, but I think the future of professionals who are needed to do certain things around this stuff is extraordinarily bright. And let me just share with you, I think this is the definition that I heard of what the difference between a data analyst and a data scientist is. And this goes back to something Ron said earlier. A data analyst is someone who looks at the data, right, and tries to figure out the answer, right? A data scientist is someone who tries to figure out new questions to ask the data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're going to need more of those scientists going forward.
We're going to need the people who are asking. I mean, think about what scientists do. They ask questions, right? Why does life exist? Is biology? What does the world exist? This is cosmology, right? So they ask questions. That's what they do. That's what scientists do. So yes. That's what we need to move into is people who ask new and better questions.
Do you see any kind of urgency in and around this profession and the people who work for it to making those types of changes?
I think there's some urgency, especially around some things that we're seeing, you know, nipping at the heels today. I'm curious to what happens even next tax season with the doubling of the standard deduction and the number of people who actually have to go to a tax professional in order to get their taxes done diminishes by half. I don't think that there will still be people who go because that's what they've always done, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not going to change. But over the course of the next few years, I think, assuming everything stays the same and there's not further changes to the tax code, but you know, I think you're going to see a big diminishment in the number of tax returns that get produced out there by professionals because there's no reason. I think I saw a stat in Forbes a number of years ago. There's no reason 70% of tax returns can't be sent to us pro forma by the government. We say, yep, that's what I have too.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And Bill, just to add that, you know, we talk about the macro level, right? The profession. If we bring it down to the micro level, the professional, what I find disturbing, and this is largely, I lay the blame on the business model for this, but a professional is someone who is paid for taking responsibility for producing a result, not delivering a series of tasks. I mean, if I want a series of tasks, I'll go hire a day laborer, right? Mow my lawn, walk my dog, clean my gutters. I hire a professional. I expect them to provide me with a transformation, take me from where I am to where I want to be. LASIK surgeon, you know, give me the best clinical efficacious eyesight possible. So professionals are paid for a result, an outcome. And yet our business model atomizes everything into a 6-minute task. And I think that's a big problem because it focuses on these tasks rather than the holistic whole of the client and producing an outcome for them.
Yeah. It's you know, it reminds me, we in Maryland, we have a firm that we work very closely with, and they tell this story all the time. They were talking with a potential new client and just trying to figure out where, you know, what needed to be done. And at one point, the CPA looked at the potential client and just asked a question, like, where do you want to be in 5 years? What do you want this business to look like? And the company hired the CPA firm on the spot. Just like
because of that question.
Because of that, and they were like, why? And he said, nobody's ever asked me that before. Yeah. So I think that's a perfect analogy. I think the more we train ourselves to be inquisitive and curious like that, the better off.
And McKinsey,
one of,
sorry, Ed, but McKinsey's really good at that. They're you know, they have great questions, and that's what they're paid for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do a session on questions, and one of the important takeaways of it is replace advice with curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what you need to do around questions is replace when you normally would give advice. Think of a question first. Right. Be curious about it.
I love that. That's great. We've talked a lot about a number of challenges kind of facing the profession. What do you think the biggest challenges that we've got to address or overcome?
There's so many. I mean, and this changes. Look, 2 years ago, I would have said relevancy. I think relevancy is still a challenge, just from a meaning the current business model of tax audit, you know, of being paid to do compliance work. That's still a big deal. But you know, I do think the biggest challenge is the mindset of the people who are currently in the profession who are not within 3 years of retirement, right? I'm less worried about the people who are almost retired because they're going to be they'll be able to run the table.
Yeah. Right?
And I'm not as concerned with the younger generation because I think some of the younger generation are beginning to get it. They're coming. They're changing the way that they're approaching things. I think there's a people in the middle, the people who are currently in their late 40s to 50s right now, who still have another at least 10 years. Those are the ones that I'm most concerned with because that's the transition people that there's going to be a lot of them who aren't able to make the transition.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I still think relevancy is way up there, and that's this idea that we need to move away from playing historians with bad memories into helping our customers create the future, right? Make history rather than just report on it. And the other thing I would say is we run our firm. You go into a firm today, and they're teaching the kids the same thing I was taught in 1984 when I joined the Big Eight accounting firm. You sell time, and they're doing the same thing. Now, there's more technology. There's more monitors on their desk than there was in my day. But the way they operate, much more efficient. But the way they operate and the way they, and more importantly, like Ed said, the way they think is exactly like it was, what has that been, 34 years ago? And you could spin it back another 50 years and it would be the same thing. That's what I find distressing.
And let me riff off of that for a second and just say, and at the risk of really getting us both wound up about this and getting it is really big trouble with a lot of people who potentially listen to this podcast. Part of the problem is the consultants to the profession who these lean Six Sigma guru, ninja turtle, black belt people who are obsessed with introducing technology and efficiency into accounting firms, thinking that this is the savior, right? Uh-huh. Right, and not realizing that really what it is the death throes of the model.
Yeah, at the end of the day, Bill, this is a relationship business, and relationships aren't built around efficiency. They're not built at staring at clocks. They're built on spending quality time, like we are here with each other, mm-hmm. and getting to know your client, asking them questions, taking the time to be proactive with them, investing the time. And you can't do that in a hyper-efficiency structure. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I worry about this profession is you go into most firms, and including the big ones, and what's their big, audacious vision? To increase realization by 3%, to improve their processes, to increase their realization rate by $6 an hour. I mean, nobody works at Google because they have great processes. People work at Google and Apple because they want to put a dent in the universe.
Yeah.
And I see a total lack of vision among most of our firms, including the top 100. I mean, the visions are absolutely wimpy. There's no John F. Kennedy, we're going to get to the moon in 10 years. There's nothing audacious. There's nothing inspiring about process improvement and workflow and project management. I'm sorry, that doesn't inspire anybody.
So somebody listening to this, they wake up tomorrow and what's the first thing they should do? I mean, how do you, after processing all of this information, what's the first step toward fixing these issues?
Read.
Yeah.
That's always good advice. Yeah, read. Just and read outside the profession, by the way. Read books. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I know you and Tom Hood are big readers. Everybody at Maryland seems to, you know, read a book a week or something, and that's really important. And I would say just try new things. Be innovative. Don't be afraid to fail. Realize that there's learning in failure. You know, my mentor, George Gilder, says wealth is knowledge and growth comes from learning. And he just doesn't mean book learning or CPE. He means doing experiments, you know, launching a project or a business and learning from that. Even if you fail, there's wealth that's been transferred. And we're just so risk adverse and loss adverse. We're afraid of failing. We're afraid of giving our people, you know, a day a week to work on whatever they want, like Google does. Why not? We're knowledge workers. Why shouldn't we be able to take a day a week and, you know, read a book or learn a presentation or a foreign language, whatever? But we just don't think that way because we're so caught up in the sufficiency realization idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what should they be reading? Like, what books have you guys read recently that's really kind of struck a chord?
We talk about books all the time on our show. We recap the best books of the year. And a book I'm about to start reading is called Life After Google by my mentor, George Gilder, who's coming on our show next week for our 200th episode. I just got this book this morning. I'm really excited to read it because he's laying out why he believes Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, you know, all of these titans that we think have all this bad monopoly power are going to be toppled by some upstart in their garage.
Yeah.
And he's been pretty prescient before with his predictions when it comes to technology. So, and he's really talking about crypto and blockchain that are going to be incredibly disruptive. And so I'm really curious to take a look at that.
Awesome.
But other books, I mean, I could tout mine. I could say that The Firm of the Future or whatever, which I think has held up pretty well for the last 15 years. But there's a lot of works out there now from various people that will help CPAs change their business model. And that would be my advice. Get up tomorrow and start changing your business model. Start changing the way you create value for your customers and the way that you capture that value through better pricing.
Mm-hmm. Ed, how about you?
Yeah, there's so much good, many, many good books out there. I would just loop back, if people haven't read it, to the one that brought Ron and I together, which is Peter Block's book, The Answer to How is Yes, because I think that book really does do a great job at understanding that it's about conversations that you're having and the need to change the nature of the conversation and the question that you're asking. It's led to so much in my life. And then one other that's more obscure that you won't find in bookstores, not that there are bookstores left anymore, but you know, you're not going to find on a top 10 list in Forbes, is a book by my mentor that Ron happened to write the foreword for. Called Healing Leadership. And the notion of this book, Howard Hansen and Steve Jeske are the authors, and it's Hansen in Hansen. And in fact, I just talked to Howard this morning, and again, as I often do, still one of my main mentors in my life. But what they challenge, and it's a double entendre, this notion of healing leadership. They think that leadership as a concept in business is broken and needs to be healed. All right, because it's more about manipulation and trying to get people to do what we want them to do. That's what leadership is considered, mm-hmm. and that's broken, and that's a problem. And it's not about task lists. It's not about listicles of the five things that you can do to more effectively communicate. Blah blah blah. All this stuff. And then the other entendre meaning of it is the notion that leadership, when practiced well, inside business, is the only thing that really can heal society moving forward. Governments cannot do this.
Yeah.
Even church organizations, civic organizations, most of them are dedicated to the preservation of the status quo, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. Governments, church organizations, even lots of not-for-profits organizations are dedicated to the preservation of the status quo. And it's only entrepreneurial business. And I used to say small business, but I think large businesses can be entrepreneurial. So, but it's only entrepreneurial businesses where the purpose is to get up and, as Ron said, put a dent in the universe, is to actually change things going forward. And that's what this book is about, that leadership, when practiced well, can actually heal people of the wounds that they experience in other places.
And it's a great book, Bill. Healing Leadership is a terrific book. And that's another thing. I'm so sick of leadership books. I mean, the last thing the world needs is another leadership book. There's a great book out there by Jeffrey Pfeiffer, who's a Stanford professor, and it's called Leadership BS. And he just calls BS on the entire leadership mantra and consulting and industry, and says, you guys talk about all these stuff, but when you look at the practice, it's pretty awful.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. I know I'm going to be reading now. how many shows have you guys done together now?
We're going to do...
Today will be 199.
Oh, closing today in at 200.
199. Next week is 200.
Next week is 200. Yep. Wow. Four years on the radio, right, Ed?
Yeah.
Who's been your most memorable guest? Like, does any one stick out above all the others?
You know, when you said the question, the one that came into my mind is one of our earlier guests, just because it was such a trip to talk to him, and he was very, but Rory Sutherland as a memorable guest, just because it went like this, Bill, and I know you're aware of who Rory Sutherland is, but it was question from Ed, Rory speaking for 15 minutes, Ed interrupting Rory saying, it's time for a break. We get back, Ron asking Rory a question, Rory talking for 15 minutes.
Makes your job easy.
For sure.
But so that's the one that popped in my mind, but there have been so many. Gilder, that, you know, Ron will talk, you know, Ron just mentioned we're having him back on. Father Sirico, Deirdre McCloskey, who is our first guest. Michael Munger, who we just recently had on, who was just completely wonderful to speak to. Dan Ariely. I mean, there's just so many people that we've been blessed to be able to interact with. And some that we're looking forward to were announced. We had him off the show, but he's going to be back on in August, is John Stossel. I'm really looking forward to that one. So, Ron, go ahead.
And most memorable, Bill, I would have to say would be Thomas Sowell, because Thomas Sowell, I think, is just a national treasure, but he doesn't do a lot of appearances on radio or TV for that matter. And we were able to get him for 34 minutes because they had asked him baseball questions, which really helped. So I would say that, and like Ed said, there's been so many, all these different economists. We even had a NASA astronaut, but I have to say my favorite show would have been with Colonel...
Chris Strickland.
Chris Elroy Strickland, who was a former U.S. Air Force Thunderbird. And I'm a huge Thunderbird fan, so that was just like a man-boy crush having him on the show.
It really was. Ron's voice is up about an octave for the entire show.
I was like a 14-year-old girl at a Beatles concert, you know, concert. I was shrieking in the, you know, it was really embarrassing for Ed.
Well, keep doing what you're doing, which to me, it boils down to making people think, which I think is really important. And I love what you guys do, and I really appreciate you guys taking the time to be here today. So thanks.
Thank you, Bill. And you guys do the same thing over there at Maryland with Tom Hood and the rest of the gang. So keep doing what you're doing, too.
Yeah, thank you.
There's plenty of room for all of us, because there's a lot of people who need to think.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. That was Ron Baker and Ed Kless, co-hosts of the influential podcast Soul of the Enterprise, Business in the Knowledge Economy. You can subscribe to their podcast in the iTunes store or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find out more by visiting edkless.com, verisage.com, that's verasage.com, and thesouloftheenterprise.com, that's the home of their podcast. Check them out. You will be smarter for it.